Session number 4841, reel 4.
Major PT, reel 4.
So, when the end of the war came, I had the pleasure of saying to the Japanese, "I told you so," which didn't please them very much, but they were terribly dejected.
We'll come on to how you were liberated a bit later, but can I ask you if you ever had any contact with home whilst you're a prisoner of war of the Japanese?
The only contact I had was one letter from my daughter, who was then a child of about 5.
At what stage did you receive that?
Fairly near the end of the captivity. I don't really remember. A lot of it had been censored. And it was only things about her dolls and things like that. And I suppose there must have been a place name or something which the British censors had deleted.
Had they received any information about your safety?
Yes. In a very vague, roundabout way. The Japanese brought in their press people on more than one occasion, and we were interviewed. The Japanese wanted to put out propaganda about the spirit of Bushido, and we were interviewed by Japanese newspaper men, and I said that we'd always be very grateful to the Japanese for giving us such a large piece of ground for a cemetery, hoping that they would take it as a compliment, which they did, but also hoping that if it was put out as a sort of a propaganda broadcast, that somebody might catch it and would get the inference that we had a lot of people dying. Well, my wife has told me since that she had a message from the Red Cross saying that a ship at sea had picked up something which they thought was spoken by a Major PT from prison war camp in Mukden. So from that point on, she believed I was alive. But for 18 months, she had no clue at all whether I was alive or dead. She did know I was in Singapore. I had managed to write to her as soon as we arrived in Singapore, simply saying, I'm in the place where your brother got engaged, which did convey something to her, but without mentioning Singapore. And that got through to her, so she knew I was in Singapore. That probably went out on the same ship that I came in, probably took the last mailbags out. But for 18 months, she had no other clue except what I've just mentioned about this radio broadcast that some ship thought it heard. But later she did have definite confirmation from the War Office, because as I understand it now, the Japanese did send in some sort of lists of prisoners of war through Geneva or neutral country or something like that. And she did get an official notification from the War Office, but this was more than halfway through the captivity.
Did you ever receive Red Cross parcels at any time?
Yes, they were all American Red Cross parcels, no British ones at all. We were too far out on the limb, I think, for anything to come from Britain. But these parcels included these sort of cartons of 200 cigarettes, for example. Now, the Japanese made us unpack these cartons and actually unpack the packs of cigarettes in case there were secret messages. So we had to take every single cigarette out of its packet and then put it back in another in batch of 20. But they were issued from time to time, about the scale of about 2 a day. And then when the Red Cross parcels came, the American system, of course, was a parcel per man. But the Japanese wouldn't have that. We had to unpack every one of the parcels, sort out the ingredients into their separate categories. So we would open, let's say, 100 Red Cross parcels, and all the corned beef would be put there, and all the cheese would be put there, etc. And then we would get an issue of one tin of beef for every four men, for example. And another day we might get one piece of cheese for every two men. That we made the... this was something which we arranged with the Japanese, actually, to spin out the parcels, because we never knew whether there was another one going to come or not. And so we used to do it that way. The parcels contained usually a half-pound piece of cheese, a three-quarter-pound tin of Spam or Prem or one of these processed pork things, bar of chocolate, some sugar. I don't remember now much more what was in them. But that was what the Japanese suggested that it would be, or what they wanted to do was to do it all themselves. But Hankins and I protested strongly because we felt sure that if the Japanese had the running of it, that the parcels would be pilfered. I mean, I can't imagine any hungry Japanese soldier resisting the temptation of pocketing the odd bar of chocolate while unpacking. So they did give us the parcels, but very often we found that they had been pilfered, but the Japanese always said, well, it was in transit, you see, you couldn't get anywhere with it. But we tried to make the most of what we had in that way, as I say, that we would issue a tin of Spam, 12-ounce tin of Spam, between four men. Well, it's nearly a quarter of a pound of meat for your meal. Didn't work out too badly.
You said that the cigarettes were inspected to make sure there were no messages contained. Mm. Did anybody actually find any messages?
Yeah. The Japanese had such suspicious minds that they almost thought there might be the actual paper of the cigarette might have writing in invisible ink on it. But they soon got tired of that game. It was just too tedious. You couldn't inspect 20,000 cigarettes individually.
You said earlier about the people who were executed for trying to escape, and you talked about the problems of making a successful escape. But did anyone ever think of attempting to cross northwards over Manchuria into the Soviet Union?
Well, that was the sort of escape route that anybody would have taken, and I think that's where the way that these three Marines did try to go. But it was about, I think, 400 miles from Mukden up, even as far as Harbin, which would be the nearest Russian border, I would think. And, of course, to get to Vladivostok and get to the sea would be infinitely difficult. But when we talked about it, it was simply daydreaming, and we all decided that it would be an absolute fool's game to try it.
Were any of the guards non-Japanese?
Yes, we had Korean guards in the early days, at Changi at any rate, but I don't think that we had Koreans in the Mukden, but I think that they had Koreans at the factory where the men worked, sort of security police at the factory.
Did you receive any different treatment from the Koreans to the Japanese?
They were much more brutal and vindictive and opportunist in taking it out on anybody. Again, I weighed this up in my own mind that Korea has been overrun by China and Japan, and the poor people there have been serfs to everybody for hundreds of years. And I think that at last some of these Koreans just had the opportunity to let loose on somebody who was even lower than themselves. I think that was their frame of mind.
As you passed through Korea, what did the condition of the Korean civilian population seem to be like?
Frankly, I didn't see very much of it. When we landed at Busan, it looked very much like the outskirts of Singapore to me. And all the East looks poverty-stricken when you just arrived there from comparative prosperity of the British Isles. In Seoul, it looked a poor city, but not poverty-stricken, you know, see, sort of a difference. I suppose that when you walk around Battersea, you don't get the right impression of London. And we were simply in this warehouse and marching to some sort of workplace. We didn't see much of it.
Could I ask you now to describe the circumstances under which you were liberated?
The first thing that happened was that an American came rushing in to me. I was upstairs in the barrack block, and he said, "Paratroops are dropping all around." I said, well, we'd heard a plane go over because there had been several air raid alerts, and we had gone through an air raid ourselves. But I rushed out, and I was just in time to see six parachutes coming down of different colours. And I said to this fellow, "That's not paratroops. They drop by hundreds, not by half dozens." And the big plane which we'd seen disappeared again. So we were left wondering. But later that evening, six people came into the camp, and as they were smoking outdoors, we knew that they weren't prisoners of war. One of them was an American colonel. I believe his name was Donovan. There were three other American officers, an American-born Chinese as an interpreter, and an American-born Japanese as an interpreter. And I believe I'm right in saying that none of them had ever made a parachute jump before. And this had been necessary because the plane was too big to land on the tiny little airfield that was near us. Or if it had landed, it would have used so much fuel in taking off that it would never have got back to its starting point. At any rate, this American, Colonel Donovan, I feel pretty sure his name, said that they'd come to organize the return of prisoners of war. And rumors were rife about we were all going to be flown out, going to be flown to Pekin, and then Chongqing, and then a place called Xi'an, S-I-A-N. But none of that actually worked out. But following that drop, that plane had dropped radio equipment, and it had dropped about four. In addition to the officers and interpreters who'd parachuted in, they'd also dropped some radio equipment, signals, and food and medical supplies. And the American Signal Corps, and I think one or two of our English people, set up the radio and started transmitting. And they got contact from a destroyer in the Pacific under the command of Admiral Nimitz, and said, "What do you want?" And we said, "Food, clothes, and medicine." And the next day, another of these enormous planes came over and dropped in 4 tons of stuff. And I think the day after that, 4 planes came over and each dropped 4 tons of stuff. And we had to say, "Stop sending. We can't eat so fast." But going along with that, at the same time, or perhaps it must have been a little bit prior to that, the Russians had arrived. And a Russian officer made a long speech. We all assembled on the parade ground. And the basis of it was simply, "You are free now. Here's the Japanese camp staff. Do what you like with them." And we rounded them up, put the officers back into their own officers' quarters, and NCOs and other ranks into their respective quarters. And we virtually took charge of the camp, except that we had told the Japanese quartermaster, "You must still keep all the supplies going, but under our authority, not under your own anymore." And this actually went on for 2 or 3 days, and I think this was before the Americans came in. I'd have to refer to my diary for dates to be really sure about that. It was all so bewildering at the end that 40 years later you rather lose the sequence of events.
Can you remember how the Russians actually arrived and what they looked like?
I remember seeing cavalry come in, each man leading a pack horse, all covered with yellow dust, whether they come across the Gobi Desert or from outer Mongolia or somewhere. But the Russians were all looting or pillaging almost. I mean, anything which could be uprooted and removed, such as lampposts or the machine tools in the factory, they were heaving it all out of sort of reparations. I spoke to one Russian artillery officer who told me they'd been using 300 guns to the mile attacking the Japanese coming in. But most of those that I was able to talk to were pretty high on vodka. It was a job to get anything very coherent out of almost anybody because they were so elated. It made me think like of the real first original Armistice Day in 1918. Which I'm old enough to remember quite well. Everybody, the Russians were all mad with joy. They weren't doing any harm. They were just rolling drunk, most of them. And their lorries were careering up the road. I mean, you could almost tell that the fellow had got no sense of touch left in his foot. It was right down on the floorboards. And it might be on the pavement, or it might be in the road. You just had to keep your eyes skinned. That was once we got outside the camp and were able to look around ourselves. I was going along, and a Russian staff car pulled up beside me, I suppose, seeing a white man in some sort of uniform. And a Russian staff officer asked me to point out on the map where some Chinese camp was, but I couldn't read the Chinese, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. His Russian name for the Chinese place. We didn't get very, very far, but we did eventually get him pointed in the right direction because I found a Chinaman who spoke just a tiny bit of English, a most tripartite conversation. So we got the Russian staff officer on his way again.
Did the Russians seem friendly towards the British PRWs?
Oh, yes, very, very friendly. I had very pleasant meetings with them. The day after we were able to get out of the camp, I strolled out entirely on my own, thinking I've never seen a Chinese city or anything. We were about a kilometre from Mukden itself, and I came across a Russian patrol, and they sort of called out, "Hello, and are you hungry?" And I said, "Yes."
In Russian?
Yes, and I sat down, and they offered me that sort of, you know, army ration bread and some rather funny cheese and a mug of very rough red wine, and I sat and chatted to them. Because I could talk Russian fairly fluently, but it was pretty difficult, really, because Russia's such an enormous country. They've got so many dialects, and I wasn't absolutely au fait. But anyway, we rubbed along all right. And then they asked me how things were, and I said that what I wanted, I was out looking for a war souvenir. That was it. Well, this little patrol, it had a corporal in charge, I think, and when I said I wanted a war souvenir, he said, "Oh, I don't have authority to give you anything. You must see my sergeant." I remember the praporshchik. And so he took me to his sergeant, and same thing. He said he didn't have any authority to give me anything, but I must see the lieutenant colonel, the podpolkovnik. So I went to see him, and he said, no, he didn't have any authority to give me anything, but they were collecting all the Japanese equipment out at a certain airfield. And he put me up on a truck with a Russian detachment that was going out there. And when I got to the airfield, I saw the commandant there, and he said, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "I'm just wanting a war souvenir." And they'd keep on sending me up further and further up the line. And he said, "Well, the only thing I've got to offer you is a four-engine bomber." So my search for a war souvenir came rather to an end. And I got back to the camp on another track that was going back, and I'd been thinking, well, if I get a samurai sword, which everybody else is collecting, I have to polish the thing for the rest of my life. So I went into the Japanese colonel's office and asked him to give me his binoculars, as I'd lost a very nice telescope of my own in the fall of Singapore, and I still have these Japanese binoculars at home. They're no different from anybody else's, except that they've got Japanese marking on them.
So what happened to you once you were liberated? How were you got home?
Well, the a British officer turned up, a solitary British officer. Goodness only knows where he came from. And what rather amused me at the time was when these American officers came in, they said to all the Americans, now, during the 3.5 years that you've been prisoners of war, you would all undoubtedly have advanced one rank. So all the corporals become sergeants, backdated. The sergeants become sergeant majors or warrant officers, backdated. Everything up to the rank of full colonel. Our solitary British officer turned up and said, well, chaps, I'm terribly sorry, but you've all had, rank, but you're temporary rank. Now you all go back to substantive rank. So the Americans all went up one and we all went down one. But at any rate, after all this talk about flying to Chongqing, evidently there weren't enough planes available, and I think that some of the very, very sick were flown out, and the very senior officers who'd come in only a few weeks before the end, they were also flown out. But for my part, we went with a party to the railway station, and the Russians had said that the train would normally took 8 hours, but would take 12 hours to get to Dairen. And it took actually about 26 hours, and it ended off by getting derailed in the docks at Dairen. And so then, with the others, I walked to the hospital ship USS Relief. And she came all down through the Gulf of Pechili, and we reached Okinawa, where there had just been a cyclone. Everything was blown flat. There didn't seem to be anybody in charge of anything. People were more or less, either people were making their own way under their own initiative, or they were sitting around waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. And of course, once you got in a place like Okinawa, you just didn't know who to look to tell you what to do. And after we got off the Relief, I found an empty tent. And the tent was shared with another officer. And we got some food. And then literally it happened like this. I saw a man standing beside a plane and asked him where he was going. And he said he was going to the Philippines. And I asked if I could go too. And I sat in the bomb racks. It must have been a B-24. But several other people were doing the same thing. So this plane had quite a payload. There must have been a dozen or so of us all sitting in the bomb bays of this plane. We left about 9 o'clock in the morning. And it was about 2 p.m, I think. We'd flown 1,200 miles across the Pacific, and we landed at Clark Field, Luzon, so he told us. And, once we got out of the plane, we didn't know quite what to do. I saw what looked like a train on the edge of the airfield, and having always been interested in railways, I wandered over and had a look. And it was a narrow gauge train. And I saw a Filipino woman, and she gave me some bananas, which I was very grateful. And I asked her what this train was, and she said it was the Manila Express. Well, I thought to myself, if it goes to Manila, I might as well go to Manila. It's a step further on. So I sat in this train and ate my bananas and waited patiently. And about 10 o'clock at night, there was a puffing noise and a strange little engine came out of the darkness, and off we went into Manila, arriving there about 1 a.m. I was really quite on my own then. I sort of walked around a bit in Manila, and I saw a jeep for the first time. I thought what an extraordinary vehicle it was, great black negro driving it, and I sort of flagged him down. and I asked if there were any British troops in the neighbourhood, and he said there was an Australian camp not far away, so I said, could he give me a ride out there? And he took me to this Australian camp and dropped me at the entrance, and I had only shirt and shorts this time. And the Australians let me in, showed me where there was a vacant tent, and I kept down for the rest of the night. And in the morning, again, I just joined a queue for breakfast. I'd lost all track of the fact that I was an officer by then. It's all so bewildering, and we were so deprived of everything, that either you wandered around rather like a sheep, or else you just waited for somebody to tell you to do something. At any rate, I never found the officer's mess there, and I never thought of looking for it. I just joined, saw a line of men with mess tins, so I just joined the line of men with mess tins and took whatever was issued to me. But when it really got moving was we went into Manila, and there a launch picked us up and took us out to HMS Implacable. And this was really wonderful, because Implacable had been sent from Australia to collect POWs from the Philippines. And the skipper told me that they still had all the planes on board when they left harbour, and the planes had flown back to land. They didn't have time to drop them. And all the aircraft hangar space had been fitted up with hammocks and bunks and so on. And there must have been 1,000 of us on board by then. I had a cabin with another officer, and I'd managed to kit myself out fairly well into the quartermaster's tent. So I was fairly presentable. And while we were on Implacable, my invaluable $120 came out from the back of that shield, and I was able to buy things. But also, while I was on Implacable, I told you the wrong story there. While I was on Implacable, I went along to the ship's paymaster and asked for an advance of pay. And he said, but you're Army, I'm Navy, I can't give you anything. And I said, oh yes, there's always ways and means around things. So he gave me £40, and that was how I had money to buy myself a gin and tonic or anything in the wardroom. And the files caught me up a year and a half later. It was deducted from my Army pay. But I lost the thread. I got two threads entangled there. This $120 that I had in the back of my ordnance badge, while I was at Mukden, I got one of the chaps in one of these smuggling operations. He exchanged these dollars for Chinese coins. The coins were smuggled out of the camp to a Chinese silversmith. And he made me a cigarette box, a little bit bigger than that. About so size.
A few inches.
It's only silver plated, but it's all the Chinese dragon, Manchu dragon, all round and round this box. It's a thing which I would like you to see, but I don't want to lend it to anybody. I don't know whether the museum would be interested in a photograph of it. I could perhaps get one of my sons to take a decent photo of it. But the family have all earmarked that, because it was smuggled back into the camp again, and I managed to bring it home. I had a handbag, you might call it. It was the remains of an old kit bag where I managed to bring a few treasures back.
So what happened to you after the Implacable?
Oh, this again was another of these remarkable things. Implacable coming across the Pacific treated us in the most amazingly hospitable way. All the entertainments possible were put on. The marine band played on deck. They gave us demonstrations of weapons that we'd never seen, like the projectile infantry anti-tank, shooting mines, which we saw, floating mines, and the marines would open up on them. And one occasion they said there would be furious joy at 10 o'clock tonight. We didn't know what this meant, but it was a feu de joie. And at 10 o'clock precisely, every gun in the ship went off with one great bang. and all the star shells going up everywhere, all the anti-aircraft guns shooting up tracer and star shells.